You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and if you'd like to listen to the show on podcast, please go to kptz.org and you can listen to this show and others. Today, we're going to be talking to Yvonne Pepin Wakefield. Many of you might have met Yvonne when she lived and taught art here in Port Townsend, but she is now an author and an adventurer and an artist who lives along the river in Oregon. She's lived for many years also in the mountains of Oregon near John Day. We will be reviewing both her memoirs. One is called Suitcase Filled with Nails, Lessons Learned from Teaching Art in Kuwait, and also her more recent book, Babe in the Woods, Building a Life One Log at a Time. Welcome, Yvonne.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you're here. I'd like you to read a little bit from your book to start us off today.
Well, I'll start from the very, 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 very first page, mm-hmm. and it's about when I actually arrived on the 80 acres I bought when I was 18 to build a log cabin, and I didn't know how to build anything, and I arrived with a bow saw and a book on how to build a log cabin. And at the time, it was April, and the snow was almost up to my knees. So this is just the first description of what I faced cutting my first tree. A pine branch jacks open the paperback, its pages flecked with snow and needles. Sweat drips off my forehead, freezes on the illustration I'm trying to follow to the T. I am 18 years old, calf deep in snow on an 80-acre mountainside I own, sawing into a tree, trying to build a home I lost 4 years ago. There is no cat, no bubbly, and lyrics written in frosty breath are really guttural sounds that rhyme with, God, itch. A book on how to build a log cabin is propped in the snow. Long hair falls in front of my eyes, and I brush it back with my mitten each time I bend to study ink drawings, diagramming the sequence and angle of the upper, under, and back cut. I've been studying those pages for nearly an hour. All I've really learned when it's so cold that snow won't melt is how easy it is to sweat through layers of flannel and wool, and what a bitch it is to saw down one goddamn tree. I swear each time I lean into that bow saw, I can hear that poor tree scream, sharp as a steel I yield, metal so cold, one lick of it, and my tongue would be stuck until spring. Further intimacy with pitted bow saw teeth, though, is absolutely the last thing on my mind as I concentrate on cutting into rough, pitchy bark and slicing clean through cadmium that's as pure and creamy as the inside of my thigh. Between the give and take of the blade, the bleed of pitch, I cross-reference the book. Judging by the diagrams, the upper and undercuts have a ways to go before they meet in a textbook V, which leads me to think I should ditch vegetarianism and become a breatharian, because I swear, really, I can feel that tree's tortured screams, sure as anything, being sliced alive. Maybe the progress is slow because the bow saw is dull. It was cheap, after all. 50 cents at a flea market. Cheaper than the $3.95 book I bought used in a bookstore back in a Minnesota city, so I can read about how to cut trees to build a cabin in an Oregon wilderness. More likely it's me, a clueless, stringy-haired, 100-pound baby-faced teenager, fresh out of braces.
So that's only the beginning.
That is the beginning.
And let me tell you, folks, it gets more wonderful from there. It gets harder from there. You know, Yvonne, you don't pull any punches here. You tell it really as it happened. And I believe you were journaling the whole time. Is that correct?
Yes, this book is actually comprised of handwritten journals and published excerpts of those journals.
Mm-hmm. And you drew as you were going to, when you had the time.
When the cabin was finally built and I had time, I drew.
That's right. That's right. This was about 40 years ago. 1974, maybe even a few years more now. In case our listeners don't remember, it was the summer that Nixon was impeached and he gave in his resignation, that you were driving across the country. The kind of the hippie dream had gone wrong. why did you and so many others head into the mountains and the forest during this time? You can tell your own story.
Well, I'm not sure why they did, and I didn't have a hippie dream. Mine was the night that my mother died when I was 14 and I was officially an orphan. I didn't know where I was going to be the next day, the next month, and I decided if I could make it until I was, at that point, 21. I knew I'd receive a small inheritance. The age changed to 18, but I had a vision that night that if I could make it, I would buy a case of cold duck, get a cat, buy a van, and go into the forest and build a cabin and write poetry and do art. And I hung on to that vision for 4 years when things were really, really awful. I was a ward of the state, put in the foster care system, which nobody wants to be in. But that was a carrot, that vision I had the night my mother died, that kept me alive during that time. When I arrived after I found property, I also came across other people in the woods doing alternative things. I don't know what their reasons were, but right. Mine was to build a home.
Build a home. Find a place. So this book is not a fairy tale. Your vision of writing poetry, doing art, some of those things happen, but the way to get there is really what this first part of your series of memoirs is all about. There's some hard stuff that happens. And, you know, some people might say that this story is pretty gritty as well as being very beautiful. There were some people, though, that shone through your characters, real people that you met in Eastern Oregon. And I particularly want you to talk about the Nelsons, the Mormon family, and Jim and Rhonda, who Jim especially became invaluable to you.
Well, as a 18-year-old orphan not knowing a soul when I arrived in John Day, all my encounters were because of serendipity. It led to one person to another. If I hadn't hit myself in the head with the bow saw and had to go to the hospital, I wouldn't have met Jim, because I went to have a cup of coffee after that and I met the owner of the bakery, and he introduced me to a man who I could hire to help me build the cabin. And Jim became my best friend, my mentor. He was everything I wasn't. But then along the way, I met other people. Like a Mormon family became kind of my surrogate family. They were there to help me whenever I needed help, unlike blood relatives. And the Tatons I talk about, actually, they're the only ones I use their real name, except Jim. They were Depression era. They grew up in the Depression. He earned $1 a day hammering fence posts, and he got a bacon powder biscuit.
Really an amazing couple.
And they didn't have much, but they gave, and they gave to me, because I think they admired me, or they either questioned why I was doing the kind of work that they had no option to avoid.
So they wanted to help you. They could see when you were in trouble. I think you break down a lot of stereotypes for people that maybe, especially in this era, have, you know, some stereotypes about people that live in rural America. And I really feel that this is a real true picture of what people were like and still are like. There were also some people that didn't really help you out. The story of how you deal with them is also part of this story. Do you want to talk about some of those situations that happened to you?
Well, a lot of it was, or some of it was, being a 18-year-old girl up in the mountains kind of opened up everybody's ideas of what could potentially work out with me. So I had one guy come up. And I'm talking about we're in the wilderness. I mean, there's no running water. You get it from the creek. You run down to get it in buckets. Kerosene lamp. It's butts up against thousands of acres of wilderness. So this guy came up in his truck a couple times with the illusion of wanting to help me. Well, he actually wanted to make some fiduciary arrangements to have me spend time with him. And there were several times like that and with people, but I dealt with it the best I could.
I think you dealt with it really well. Let's talk more about exactly what it was like there. You didn't sort of just go into the woods like you might in a town in Port Townsend, you know, just off Discovery Bay or something. This was really the wilderness. So describe how you got and how you found your 80 acres of land.
So the day I turned 18, I met with my state-appointed attorneys, trust officer, probate judge, all that, signed some paperwork, took off in my little green gremlin, and headed to Oregon. I'd never been to Oregon before. but I'd read about it in books. So I drove all over Oregon trying to find virgin timber and a creek. And all the realtors in Bend and Sisters, Redmond, they all said, that's been logged up 40 years ago. So they said, go to John Day. And I had driven through there a week before and I laughed at it because who names a town John Day? So I went back and I immediately found a realtor who respected me and took me to find some up in the mountains, and he was showing me property, and I heard this sound, and it was a creek below. And I said, well, I want to look at that property. He said, well, it's not for sale. And so we went there, and I said, I want to buy this property. So he went down and investigated, and I ended up buying 80 acres, butting up against the Strawberry Mountain Wilderness with a creek and still some old-growth ponderosa pine. Mm-hmm. So the road that goes up there is an old logging road. It was logged below in the 50s. And the road is pretty much the same as it was back then. But when I first started, I didn't have a vehicle that could take on that road.
No, you had a gremlin.
And the gremlin stayed parked, and I packed up I packed up almost everything, except when the roads were dry, then Jim could use his truck.
So there was a lot of walking. You got pretty strong, pretty fast, because you had to. Just your description of cutting down that first tree. There's some physical limitations between, you know, what women can do and what men can do. And this was a time when we all thought, okay, we're going to go out and we're going to show the world. I mean, you carried around, you had your subscription to Ms. Magazine. But when you face the reality of being in the Western United States and trying to do what you did, it's really hard. How did you overcome? And how did you kind of keep going when, I mean, you were physically hurt? I've been in some of those situations, and I have to say, I gave up. So I'm really interested in why you didn't.
Well, part of it is like if you're learning a new sport, if you're just becoming a runner or a football player, you're going to get hurt no matter what. So for me, I'm learning to use tools that I've never used before in an environment I've never worked in before with weights that were most of the time insurmountable to me. What I did is I found ways to adapt tools that would work for me. For instance, we were straddling the logs, notching them, and Jim was using a long pole axe. And for me to use the same pole axe, I was about, you know, probably a third of what he was weight and height. It was just all convoluted, and I couldn't execute the hatchet marks. So what I did is I went down, I threw the axe down out of anger, and I picked up a hatchet. And because it was a smaller tool, I could yield it better. It took me a lot longer, but I got the job done. And I found that in many, many instances, I would just have to learn how to readapt a tool. But until that experience with the hatchet, I always thought I had to use the tools that worked for men. And they didn't make little tools, smaller tools for women at that time.
Okay, so you bought a chainsaw?
I did. I bought it. The only mechanical things used on building that cabin were chainsaws. Mm-hmm. Everything else is done by hand. There wasn't any pulleys to get the logs up or anything. But yes, I found a chainsaw, an Echo chainsaw that fit me. I don't have that Echo, but I have another Echo.
Oh.
Because it's just my size chainsaw.
Right. It didn't just come easily. First you bought a big chainsaw, that didn't work. Then you found a smaller chainsaw. You bought a truck. Tell us about Tank and what happened with Tank.
So I met this man while I was buying a draw knife. He sold used things, and he told me about this truck. So we went out in this farmer's ranch, and I bought this. I think it's a 1962 Dodge, I think I call it, 3/4-ton pickup truck. It didn't have power steering it was an old truck. At face value, it even looked run down, but after I started to drive it, it was even more broken. So it became this story of upkeeps. But it was too big for me to drive, so I had to sit on two pillows, and I had to tape blocks of wood on the clutch and the brakes so I could
I think what you were doing
it.
Is looking at what you could load it up with.
It could haul. That thing could haul. It could haul than any truck I had, but it also didn't have an emergency brake, which was fun because when you'd get up to the mountain, you'd have to put rocks under the tires so it didn't roll back. And
So it got your stuff from around the valley and up to the first gate, so to speak.
Until the snows came. And then when the snows came, it stayed down 3 miles below. So I would have to get to town, which I did after the snows came, every week to 10 days, I would load up a backpack and start hiking. Oh, I put my skis on, ski about a mile down cross country, put the skis in the woods, hike up over a mountain, clear off the truck, chain it up, and drive to town.
So you had some cross-country skiing skills before you came to Oregon, or not? Where did you?
Yes, well, I spent 8 years in Minnesota, so I was a real avid skier downhill and cross-country.
Okay, so that helped. No snow machines there in John Day.
Well, now they do, but...
Yes, not then. Not then. Okay, so you hauled a lot. You backpacked a lot. Took it up to your site. Now... One thing, you know, it sounds, I mean, to find a place that has the logs and has the creek and some of the old growth, it is idyllic, but it is north-facing, right? So that's why there was a lot of snow?
Well, it's in a mountain draw, and it's at 5,700 feet.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I couldn't get up this month, because they've got record snows up there.
That's right. So you mentioned this month, so you still... have this place. You didn't give it up.
No, and one reason I moved to the Dalles, Oregon, is because when I lived in Port Townsend, it would take me 12 hours to drive there. Now it's a four-hour drive from where I live in the Dalles.
Okay, so you're still going to this place, and we can still see it, and you have... I really recommend going, if you have the opportunity... You know, going and listening to Yvonne talk about her books, because she'll, you know, they're slides. And
also on my Facebook page, The Suitcase Filled with Nails and Babe in the Woods, I often post pictures when I'm up at the cabin. Mm-hmm. And then there's a blog site, Babe and the Woods, and I'll post photographs and things on there.
Okay. So you're a babe in the woods in more than one respect. This is a great title, because it talks about the fact that you didn't know much, but you had a lot of grit, and you were ready to learn. In this book, you do a great job of weaving in the story of the years that you were an orphan, which, you know, were not easy times for you. You talked about the vision that you had that got you through those 4 years. What was your anchor? I mean, you hung out with some, you know, kind of, I don't want to call them lowlives, but, you know, some people in your life that didn't think much beyond where they were going to, you know, get their next drink.
Or smoke,
or, you know, they were pretty much living day by day. So what was your anchor? What kept you going?
Well, it was the vision of this cabin and researching it during that time. And there wasn't any CPS, Child Protective Services, then, or counseling. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of thrown in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're vulnerable prey to anything that goes on.
Did you have mentors? Did you have teachers or anyone that kind of guided you that you felt?
No.
No, really. So, but you were writing... You had a vision of yourself as an artist and a writer.
Well, yes, I'd always done art and I'd always written, but I never took a formal art class until senior high, because I thought that's where all the dumb kids, lazy kids hung out, were in the art classes. That was my perception. Mm-hmm. And so when I was senior high, I had to take an art class, and I did, and then I took college level. So I'd always been in the arts. And then the journaling helped. You know, I wrote teenage angst poetry.
Of course.
And that helped get through some of the harder times.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about sort of the basic day-to-day things like food. I was really fascinated by what you basically lived on and ate. And it did become your role to, you know, there were a couple guys that came through that helped you work on the land. And the deal was that you would feed them. So how did you eat up there, and, you know, what was life like day by day?
We ate simply because there was no refrigeration. If you refrigerated items, it would be in the creek. So life was simple. It was a lot of vegetarian-based food, even though, I was a vegetarian then. It was Tillamook cheese, peanut butter, homemade bread. I learned how to grind grains to make bread, and whatever vegetables would keep.
Yeah, and you made the bread. It was kind of like a flat bread in just in a pan on the stove, right?
Right, and I still do it. I was up there burning brush in November, and I was still making bread in the Dutch oven in the fire.
Mm-hmm. Dutch oven in the fire.
And so the day-to-day existence is after I got in the cabin and there was nobody around anymore. Jim didn't come. There was like nobody. Mm-hmm. So it was me. I had to keep up a really regiment of doing things at a certain time and following through on it. So for instance, the day thing for me was, I was actually taking college credits then, independent. So I'd get up at 4 or 5 in the morning, light the lamps, get dressed in a pullover. And it's a yellow Woolrich pullover sweater with a little, and it had a shirt with a little collar I put out, and I put clean jeans on, wash up, and I do my homework.
And go to school.
I go to school. And then at exactly 10 o'clock, I would eat something and put on my yucky work clothes and go out and work in the woods, because I was also getting my winter wood supply.
You were trying to get in your winter wood, which is, you know, no small task. I mean, there's cords and cords and cords to be.
Yeah.
And it's not just, it's just not in a pile, left in a pile for you. You
no, it means you fall the tree, buck it up, haul it to the site, split it up, stack it. And so then at 4 o'clock, it was starting to get dark in the draw. So I'd go back in, I'd clean up, put on clean clothes again, different sweater though for nighttime.
Oh, okay.
And do my reading and do my art, eat a little bit of something. And I just kept that regime. And I would not read anything that would take my mind into realms I didn't want to explore, like Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm. Because you're alone there. And if you didn't have a clean, clear mindset, you could cannibalize your mind. I mean, you could kill yourself easy.
Right. By
overactive imagination. And
reading a lot and being part of the book that you're reading for days and days and days. Right. So did you have a kerosene lamp or did you have Coleman lamp? What'd you do for light?
I have kerosene lamps. I still have the same lamps. And I think I'm still using, no, I must have another barrel, but I'm still using kerosene. Everything
the silver ones that hang with the
chimneys? No, they're just the glass ones.
Yeah, just the glass ones. Okay.
I did have a Coleman when I was doing drawing up in the loft. Mm-hmm. And it gave better light, but I didn't like the sound.
No, hissing.
You know, it's the same as there when I go up now as it was when I was a teenager.
Right. And the wood stove? What kind of stove did you get?
I got a stove. It's called a Frontier. It was made by a man in Bend. Mm-hmm. And it acts as kind of a fireplace and a cook stove.
Mm-hmm. Does it have a little oven? No,
but you can cook on the top.
Yeah, of course. Cook on
the top. If you get it that hot.
So you had that stove in there. Must have been fun getting it into the cabin.
Well, the Mormons helped me. We put it in a cat bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Picked it up.
Lifted it up there. So you're all alone. Did you have any pets?
I had my cat. Mm-hmm. I had a cat that acted like a dog most of the time.
Okay. Well, cats can do that, especially if they're out there hunting. We're talking to Yvonne Pepin Wakefield, and you're listening to Book Lovers Cafe. This is 91.9 FM right here in Port Townsend. We'll continue talking to Yvonne in just a minute. I want to say that she's written a couple of memoirs. One is called Babe in the Woods, Building a Life One Log at a Time. And you'll find out a lot about building a log cabin from scratch in this book, as well as what it takes to survive as a young woman alone. And also, her first book, which was also a memoir, Suitcase Filled with Nails, Lessons Learned from Teaching Art in Kuwait. Now, I want to talk a little bit about that book. This is a book about your life much more recently.
Yes.
And so skipping over a few decades, and now we're in a time when America has turned towards the Middle East. And Yvonne, you find yourself going and teaching in Kuwait. Tell us a little bit about this story.
Well, I was at that time happily ensconced in my role as an art specialist in the Squim School District with tenure and health insurance. But I had a PhD and it wasn't being actualized in that environment academically. So I'd been applying for all these professorship positions and got shortlisted. And then on a fluke applied to an advertisement for an artist with a PhD to teach at a women's college in Kuwait, and I was accepted. So long story short, I went there not knowing anything. In fact, it was right after Iraqi freedom in 2003, so a lot of the expat population had left. And I had no idea that months before bombs were falling in Kuwait. No idea. I could find no information on Kuwait. There weren't the websites and things like there are now.
No State Department warnings.
I found the two books I found was one was on a statistical book on the oil, and the other was Jean Sassoon's Rape of Kuwait, which you should not read before you go to that country. So I arrived not knowing anything, and it was difficult on many levels. But I think the fortitude that I developed building the cabin was the same kind of fortitude that kept me coming back to Kuwait. When things get tough, you just keep going through until you resolve them. So I taught for 6 years.
That was a hopeful time. That was a time when we were thinking, hey, we're making some breakthroughs here. We're going to do something good for the women.
But see, I did not go with that idea that I was going to enforce my values, or I was going to liberate, or I just went to do the job I was hired to do, which was to teach art. And I found I could not teach it the way that I had been taught to teach art because of social constraints. And it's an iconic culture. So you couldn't use nudes. You couldn't use faces. And oftentimes, my students couldn't even render a flower because only God could make the flower.
So we think that you can do natural, do the art, but it's all stylized.
It's different now. It's really different. My students were drawing, by the time I left, they were drawing portraits, not under my tutorialship, because I didn't want to get incarcerated. But I'm still in touch with a lot of those students, and they send me work, and it's amazing, beautiful portraiture.
Okay, so now your life, would you say that you're spending more of your time as a writer now, or as an artist, or a little bit of both? Tell us about what your life is like now.
Well, I have a really interesting life. So I have another home and studio in Tiatin, Washington. It's in this little developing arts community, and it's in a renovated Apple warehouse. So I do my painting there. The 6 years I was in Kuwait, because they didn't have landscape, I painted pomegranates, painted paintings of pomegranates.
I've seen those. They're beautiful.
So I haven't painted them since. And in November, I started again. So I have a show in March. In October at the Columbia Arts Center in Hood River. On new pomegranates. I'm working on that. So my schedule is, I usually write in the morning, then I'll do my marketing, and then I'll do my art. And my art over in the Dalles, I have a ceramics studio right on the river. And it's basically only pit-fired ceramics. So that's how I balance my time.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we are privileged to be able to talk to Yvonne Pepin Wakefield today and hear about her adventures, her art, and her writing. Some other books that you might be interested in reading, of course, Cheryl Strayed's Wild, Lost and Found on the Pacific Crest Trail, which kind of goes near your place in John Day, sort of. No, not really. Well, anyway.
In the Dalles, it does.
In the Dalles, right. But I do want to say that this book has some pretty exciting things that happen in it. It's different than Cheryl's book. I'd also like to recommend Gertrude Bell, Queen of the Desert, Shaper of Nations, as a memoir of a strong woman who decides to go out into the Middle East. This is in the late 1800s, very different time period. Some of you perhaps have read Jeanette Walls, The Glass Castle, a woman that overcomes a very strange and bizarre childhood. Also, fairly recently, Sally Mann's memoir, Hold Still, a memoir with photographs, a strong woman artist, and her life. So these are some possible books that you might turn to. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, and you can also make a donation to the station as well. Larry Stein, Mike Schlexer have all helped with this program, and I'm really indebted to them and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. Please stay tuned to listen to some more great music and talk from the people in your very own community. This is Chris Wilson. We'll see you next time.